Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Michael's Mixdown. Michael's Mixdown is a show primarily about the recording arts, so whether you heard it in the studio or in the stadium, you can hear about it here on Michael's Mixdown. Joining me today is Peter Rothbart, who I saw once while I was in college some odd years ago. We don't need to say how many years ago, right? But it was some odd years ago. And brought to my attention this album that he was touring around and doing some songs and telling stories about. And I have admired that album ever since I heard it the first time. And I really wanted to have him on and talk about how that album came to be. So thank you again for joining me today, Peter. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
My pleasure to be here, Michael. Thank you for inviting me. And I commend you on your announcer voice that you just broke into when you started that intro.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I kind of break into that, I guess, talent of mine. Because I did have a guy on the show not too long ago, and he goes, "You don't sound like that in real life. I've talked to you like person to person. You don't sound like that." And I said, "Well, you know, you put it on for the show."
We all have our performative voices and idiosyncrasies.
Right, right. So the album is called You Are What You Dream, and it came out in 2012, and I probably saw you that year or the next year. I honestly couldn't remember off the top of my head which one, what year we saw you, but you were doing a tour of sorts with your brother, right? His name was Davey or David?
Yeah.
Davey?
Dave. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, I guess, that tour and how that got started, and you were going to, I think, different college campuses, and where else did you sure. did you end up at?
So back in 2001, roughly, my brother started an art project, I guess you could call it. It was a magazine called Found Magazine, and what Found Magazine is a collection of notes, letters, pictures, stuff that people find all over the country, all over the world, and they send it in, and then my brother would put it together into this magazine. In 2003, after he had been touring on his own for a couple of years, sharing some of the best finds with people around the country, I started touring with him. I began writing songs based on some of the found notes, and so we began touring in 2003 together, and we did that for a full decade, more than a decade. And so the show that you saw in Muncie back in, I believe you're right, 2012, that would have been a Found Magazine show where, again, my brother presented some of the best finds that had come into us recently and some of our favorite classics. And then I played some songs that I had written based on some of the found items. Several of those songs are included on this album.
So the were all of the lyrics or just some of the lyrics based off of the found notes, or how exactly did that work?
On found notes. That's track 4, which is The Baddest Nissans in the Northwest, and track 5, which is A Child to Call Your Own. So both of those songs were based on notes that were found in various places. The Baddest Nissans in the Northwest was found in Oregon City, Oregon, a suburb of Portland. And then A Child to Call Your Own was based on a note that was found in Hawaii. I don't remember exactly where.
So the notes basically were found by people and sent in to the magazine. Is that how it
worked? Right, exactly. And I don't remember much about the context in which The Baddest Nissans in the Northwest was found. But there is an interesting story behind A Child to Call Your Own. I could tell that now, or I could wait until we talk about that song.
Go ahead and tell me about that, because I do really enjoy that song, and I think I mentioned to you that I thought it was one of the saddest songs I'd ever heard, and it was.
Well, it's one of the saddest notes I've ever read.
On the floor of our air-conditioned apartment, I'm trying to temper my fears, waiting for the results of a pregnancy test, and I don't know what I want to hear.
The person who sent it in found it in the burnt out remains of a automobile on the side of a road in Hawaii. Looked like maybe the car had caught fire or, you know, been in a wreck and subsequently been put on fire. And there was, still inside the car, there were various belongings scattered about. So they pulled this note out. I think it was a journal, a diary, something like that. They pulled these pages out. And it's a woman who has just had her, it's written by a woman who has just had her second miscarriage. And she's understandably devastated. You know, she's suffering, she's in pain. And at the same time, she's trying to figure out whether she wants to try again to have a child. And it wasn't, her pain wasn't something I felt like I could relate to directly, being a man. But what I tried to do with this song was I tried to envision what it was like for an imaginary partner, you know, who's trying to have a baby with her and is trying to help her through the grieving, you know, trying to support her while she's grieving through the miscarriages and trying to remain positive about their prospects of having a baby in the future. So I tried to look at it from this imaginary fellow's perspective. And that's where the song came from.
Right. So one of the things that in that song and others that got my attention was that your style of writing lyrics and adapting these notes into lyrics was kind of a, I don't know how to phrase it exactly, but it sort of captures this picture of life that I, you know, have here in the Midwest. And there's a lot of songs about like country singers and stuff. And they sing about, you know, a lot of stuff that happens in the Midwest, farming and all that kind of stuff. But that's not my, you know, my picture of life. It doesn't match what I do or, you know, what a lot of people in Indiana aren't just farmers. And so it, like, the unair-conditioned apartment, that bit was kind of like, I mean, I've never lived in an unair-conditioned apartment, but I've lived in apartments and I can picture, you know, I can just see that so easily. And I don't know, it's like almost like an Americana style of writing, and it just sort of captures this essence of this Midwest kind of, you know, this place that I live. There was another lyric, I think, in the first song where you talked about seeing kids riding by on their 10-speed bikes. And you could have just said bikes, you know. You could have just, they could have just been, you know, any kind of bikes. But to throw in that they were on their 10-speed bikes, it just sort of like, it's not, you know, a huge difference, but it's enough of a difference that it makes it easier to picture for me. And I just think that that's interesting where...
I'm glad you appreciate those nuances. I think that as a songwriter, lyrics like that serve two purposes. One is just to fit a meter that you have in your head. So so those specific lyrics that you called out helped fill the meter that was needed for that phrase of the song. But also I really appreciate when songwriters add that level of detail. You mentioned when you first contacted me a few weeks ago, you mentioned Counting Crows. You said you thought that some of my songs were reminiscent of that. That's a very high compliment. I love Adam Duritz's songwriting. I love Counting Crows. I thought of a few examples from Counting Crows songs that just struck me similar, like in Round Here, for example, how one of the phrases I've always loved is Maria came from Nashville with a suitcase in her hand and said she'd like to meet a boy who looked like Elvis. And it's just, it just paints such a vivid portrait of someone in so few words. And I think there's a lot of words in songwriting that get used as filler. And I try to be really efficient with the language I use. I try not to waste syllables. So I try not to use those filler words, and I try not to use words that don't, you know, that don't add anything to the story. Sometimes it ends up making my songwriting too verbose, but I'm mindful of that as well. So I try not to stuff too many words in. So it's a combination of you know, what paints the picture that you're trying to paint and what fits well rhythmically into the song.
Right. Yeah, there's a line in one of the new Counting Crows songs that just came out beginning of last year, I believe, where he's talking about a kid named Bobby, and the line goes, he has his head held down a lot, but when he wears his blue jean flares, he bubbles like a 7-Up. And I just thought it was simple, but it was, I mean, he could have just said the kid looked really good in his jeans
or
whatever.
Right. But there's this richness of description. That's what makes a song. I think that's what makes good writing as well. That's what really sets apart my favorite authors. You know, you can tell a story maybe not as many words as you want, but perhaps there's some lower bound and some upper bound, but there's a wide range of the number of words you can use to tell a story. And I'm very selective about which words I use and which words I don't.
Yeah. Well, and that comes through, I think, in the songwriting in that album, because I caught it right away and I've admired it ever since. So yeah, you're welcome. And it's like I said, it's not always about being, you know, really complex and philosophical, but just adding a little bit of life, a little bit of, you know, just enough to add more to the mental picture of, you know, when you're imagining what's going on in a song. It's a nice touch. And like I said, I've just admired that. So, one of my other questions was, I'd seen a little bit of evidence that this tour had kind of went around to a few different college campuses. So how extensive was this tour, and where all did you guys go?
2012, if it was 2012, would have been a national tour. It was not one of our bigger national tours, so I don't remember at this point exactly how many cities it was, but it was probably around 75 or 80 cities. Biggest tour was back in 2004. We did a 50-state tour, and that was something like 130 cities spread out. It was kind of done in two chunks. We did like a spring and early summer section, and then we did a fall, early winter section. That was something like 130 cities, maybe 150 shows. That was nuts. I don't ever want to do that again. But this tour, the 2012 tour, was probably about 75 or 80 cities, if I remember correctly. And college, we love going to college campuses because their students and faculty and just college communities are really artistically inclined and really receptive to what we're doing. You know, we done shows in a lot of places where we were not well received. You saw our show. I know it was a decade ago, but it can get pretty raunchy in parts and unpleasant in other ways. It's not G rated, you know, it's not PG-13 rated. So there were a lot of shows we played that weren't very well received, but college campuses always went well. I'm, you know, like any performer, we enjoy performing to a crowd that's engaged and enthusiastic. And we were routinely met with that on college campuses. Another thing we liked about college campuses is that you can often do daytime shows. So you can kind of get a two for one you can do two shows in one day. You can do an afternoon show at a college campus. I don't remember if that's what we did in Muncie, but you can, do an afternoon show in Muncie and then an evening show in Indianapolis or something like that, so you can maximize your time. And then of course, the other thing we like about college campuses is that they often pay really well. So, we would often get a pretty good fee for showing up and performing at a college campus. So all those things combined, if we could just do a college tour, I would be thrilled. I love performing on college campuses.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the show could get a little raunchy at points, and one of the highlights of that show I remember was the booty don't stop and the story behind that. Yep. And
So the booty don't stop, for your listeners who don't know, is based on a cassette tape that was found. Again, this is a item sent into Found Magazine. It was found by a guy in Ypsilanti, Michigan, which is pretty close to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where my brother and I are from. And it was this cassette tape full of 30-second to minute-long booty rap songs made by what sounded like a couple kids and like a Casio keyboard. And there are these great songs like Wave Your Booty in the Air. And each song is basically just one phrase repeated over and over and over. So Wave Your Booty in the Air, or She Got That Wide-Ass Wumpin'. That's another. And then the Booty Don't Stop was one of my favorites. And so I wrote this cover song, this really sweet sort of love ballad, like a boy band style love ballad, called The Booty Don't Stop. Basically incorporating the scant lyrics that existed on the original tape and then adding my own verses to it. And yeah, I love that song. That song was always pretty... Not always. That song was always well received on college campuses. Not so much at the library in Ocean Shores, New Jersey. Ocean Shores? I think that's the name of this town. We did a library show once. It was just a room almost full of retirees, and they hated us. They practically booed us off the stage. So the Booty Don't Stop is not actually on, it's not on this album.
No,
I did record it as like a hidden track on my first album, which is called Songs for the Long Lonely Drive. So I used to have a Public Enemy CD. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Music and Our Message. And I had something about the CD player I had at the time. This would have been when I was in like middle school or early high school. Something about the CD player I had at the time made it so that it accidentally like would rewind. If I was trying to back up to the beginning of a track, sometimes it would accidentally rewind. And so one time I was playing it and it rewound past the beginning of the first track into negative time. And there was actually recorded audio before the first track started. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And so I vowed to myself, when I release an album, I'm going to have a hidden track in negative time. And because, most people would put hidden tracks at the end of an album, maybe they put some space in between or something. And it sort of naturally comes on if you just leave the album playing. But I wanted people to have to work for it. So I hid the Booty Don't Stop in negative time on my first album. It didn't really fit the rest of the album tone-wise. I didn't want it to play naturally if you were just playing through the whole album. So that was my solution. I still love that song. Haven't played it in a long time, but I haven't had occasion to play it in a long time, but it still has a place in my heart.
Right. There's a few recordings of it on YouTube where somebody in the crowd, got it on a cell phone or whatever. And once in a while, maybe once a year or so, I will pull it up just to give myself a laugh because I still think fondly of that song. Well,
one recording you may be able to find. I know it used to exist on YouTube. I'm not sure if it still does. We did a benefit show. We were part of a benefit show for It was sponsored by both NPR, or not sponsored by. It was a benefit show put together by NPR and I'm struggling to remember the name of it, but Dave Eggers used to have this, or he still does have this organization of the teen writing centers, for teenagers. 826, that was it. Have you ever heard of that? It's Dave Eggers opened this. It started with this storefront in San Francisco, and he opened a teen writing center, just a nonprofit teen writing center. This doesn't have anything to do with my music, of course, but I think it's a good story. and he that for some reason the city said like a nonprofit storefront wasn't allowed there, and that he had to have a store, like he had to be selling something. And so they made basically this faux storefront that legitimately sold something like, I can't remember what the storefront was in San Francisco. I think it was like robot supply or something like that. Robot products. So they sold all these products for like taking care of your robot or something like that. But then in the back, they just had the teen writing center. And so it was, and it became, they opened a few other centers. There's one in Ann Arbor. There's one here in Seattle, the Space Travel Supply Company. And there are a few others around the country. Anyway, so he has this nonprofit, 826, and we were doing a benefit concert in Ypsilanti, Michigan at the Pease Auditorium. And we were like the bottom rung of the acts. Dave Eggers apparently knows some bigwigs. So the Cowboy Junkies were there, and Stephen Malkmus from, do you know who that is? Stephen Malkmus and the Jinx. I'll be honest, I didn't really know who he was before then, but at that concert, I found out that everyone I knew who he was. So, and I feel like there was one other person there, I'm forgetting. But at any rate, the way our show sort of, they sort of pegged us in at the end, a reprise of our part of the show, where I played the Booty Don't Stop, and all these famous musicians come out on stage and sing it with me. they were the back line, you know, the singing the choruses.
Yeah, like an ensemble.
So you can find this video of me playing the Booty Don't Stop with like the Cowboy Junkies singing back up, and I love it. It felt like one of those moments where they probably didn't really want to sing that. That wasn't really what they had in mind that day, but they're sort of railroaded into it, and they were polite enough to not refuse. I appreciated that.
Right. Well, it's got a catchy enough chorus that it would be hard not to sing along to it, I think. Yeah. So. Well, and if I hadn't already at this point in the show, I will try to find some capture of that song and edit it in somewhere so people can hear what we're talking about.
Sure. I can, there must be there are definitely a few audio or a few YouTube videos that have good enough audio, but if you can't find one, I probably have a recording, an MP3 or something I can send you.
Let's get it on. I tell you that you're special, that you're the only one. And I say I love you though we haven't been together long. I take you to the movies and I show you all my moves. And you know when I play basketball, I bust that chain for you. You turn on the light. I do it for one reason. I won't feed you any lie. When I first saw that ass, I knew I had to make it mine. Cause damn, the booty don't stop, girl. Damn, the booty don't stop, girl. I plead. And Papa says, when to have you home? If I wanna keep my knees, shorty, tell your family, stop fronting on my game. Cause if I don't get to touch that ass, I'll never be the same. Well, other girls may have it, and even more may try. But baby, I don't love them hoes, and let me tell you why. Cause I wanna warm that ass up and tap it like a phone. I call it on those nights I'm cold and feeling so alone. Singing,
so to get back to You Are What You Dream, there's a lot going on in as far as instruments, and there's another singer backup, like a backup company singer sometimes. So I was wondering who all these people were, and if they were studio musicians or friends of yours, or where all these people came from, and how did you manage to cram them all on one album?
Sure. I'm looking at the album cover to remind myself who all is on it. The musician who contributed most to You Are What You Dream is a woman named Aura Riddell. We're both looking for, we were looking to form a duet, and our interests aligned, and we started playing music together somewhere around 2008 or 9, I think. And our voices just go together really well. Our musical tastes fit, and we had a great time playing music together for years. And she remains one of my favorite people of all time to play music with. And you know, we got to be friends. We're not especially close friends, but, Aura is just, she's a class act all the way around. Apart from her stunning musical talent, she's just a warm, generous, enthusiastic person, fun to be around. And it makes me so proud and happy to have her on this album and playing such a prominent role. So yes, the woman you hear singing, and then her, she also plays piano. She's a brilliant pianist. And so you can hear her contributions in most of my favorite songs on this album. First Son.
Kids ride screaming by on their 10-speed bikes. And sailboats dot the harbor like stars on a cloudless night. There's music floating from Capitol Hill. Everyone's moving, the time standing still, cause we feel immortal in such radiant light. The cold, pale months that huddle us together are as dear as a childhood lullaby. But the glow and touch of the coming summer made me so in love with being alive.
And Don't Let the Hard Times Rule You.
When a hammer is your only tool, every problem looks like a nail. But you can't just pound away each day to no avail. Oh, courage and fearlessness, they aren't quite the same. Courage is being scared and doing it anyway. Falling in holes is the cost of treading unknown ground. Life takes its toll. Tired and slipping, struggling to get control.
and When I Rise.
When I rise, let me rise like a bird without regret. When I fall, let me fall like a leaf without regret.
I love everything she added to this album. She really, it wouldn't be what it is without her. And then moving down the line, so I was playing an Irish bluegrass band for about 5 years, back in the early 2010s. And that introduced me to a lot of musicians around the Seattle area. So I met Joe Capocha. He's a great bass player, and he plays other instruments as well. He's been in a number of bands around the Seattle area, the Blackberry Bushes, among others. And Jacob Breitbach and Dave Harmonson as well. We call him Country Dave. All three of those guys were guys I played with on and off in this band, and just guys I knew around the local music scene. They're all, again, stunningly talented musicians. I was really lucky to have access to such talent. And, you know, they were kind enough to, I mean, I paid them, but they were kind enough to come in on, you know, on their day in the middle of the day and come into my basement studio and spend time learning the songs and recording them. And, you know, again, my first album, I think almost everything I recorded on my own. And that album suffers from a number of issues. One being that I just wasn't that good of a recording engineer at the time. But I think another is just that I did too much. There's too much of me on there. And I could have probably played some of the parts that these guys played, upright bass, certainly I could have figured out, but it wouldn't have had the same feel to it. Yeah. These three were indispensable in the album's production. And then the other three people who appear on this album, one is Dave Riddell. That's Aura's husband. He plays trumpet on one track on the Baddest New Sounds in the Northwest.
Yeah.
He's not a professional trumpeter, but he was just happy to contribute. And then David George Gordon plays harmonica on Don't Let the Hard Times Rule You. And he's another guy I met on Craigslist. I think I just posted an ad saying I needed a harmonica player. And I got way more response than I given the specificity of my request. But he replied really enthusiastically. And I thought his harmonica solo in that song and just to sort of the backing, the what do they call it? The padding. Padding that he adds. His harmonica solo and the padding that he adds to that track rounds it out really nicely. And then finally, Stuart Reed is a longtime friend of mine. And I needed someone to sing bass on When I Rise. And I'm sure I could have found anyone to sing bass, but I like bringing on people I know, even if they're not the best performer. I would rather, it means more to me to have someone I know play on my album than it would to have, to have it sound 3% better and have it be someone I don't know, or even 10% better or 20% better. I'm willing to trade off proficiency for sentimentality.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, speaking of that song, the harmonies on that song, I was just telling my girlfriend earlier today, I was subjecting her to your music, and which, by the way,
subjecting isn't really the verb I would want people to use, but go ahead.
Okay. I didn't mean to any offense, but I was like, you're going to listen to this because I'm going to talk to this guy later. And she was like,
no offense.
I was pointing out, I said, I really like this harmony in this song. And she was like, yeah, that is a really nice harmony.
Which song?
And When I Rise with the guy you were saying.
Yeah, at the end. I think, you know, you get these opinions of your songs after the fact. And When I Rise, it means a lot to me personally, the song does. But after the fact, I start thinking, maybe it's a little too slow. A little monotonous, you know, it's steady. It's not exactly boring, but it doesn't have quite enough going on. But when the instruments shut off and that last chorus kicks in, it's beautiful. I could listen to that all day. And I love having those moments. There are other moments like that around the album, I think, that I just, that make me really proud of it.
When I fall, let me fall like a leaf without regret, joyfully, joyfully.
Yeah. So you recorded this in your own like basement studio?
Yeah. So I was living with a high school friend of mine and her husband, in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle. And we had this big basement, that wasn't really, wasn't, I hear your dog whining.
Yeah, he's not very happy, but if I let him in here, I think he's just going to rumble around and make more noise.
Poor guy. So we had this big basement space that was perfect for a studio because there were kind of two rooms near each other, one that could be used as a control room and one that could be used for a recording space. You know, it wasn't a professional studio by any stretch, but as far as like a home studio goes, it was a pretty good space. And so, yeah, I recorded this over the course of less than a year. I don't remember exactly. But all just in that basement, just had people come over when they could for the other musicians who contributed. And I tried to, negotiate with my roommates, my housemates, when I needed things to be quiet and
Yeah.
And also tried to keep the volume down when I was mixing. And,
right.
And yeah, it worked out. It helps to be living with one of your best friends in the world, that part of it. They're more accommodating that way.
Right.
Yeah. But it was all recorded in that basement.
So, do you remember what kind of like equipment you use? I mean, even if you don't have every single thing, but you know, I'm guessing that you probably had like a laptop and interface and some different mics and probably not like a giant tape recorder.
Right. No, it was all digital. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember which computer I used. I think it was a laptop. I think it was an old Toshiba satellite laptop. And then okay. All the mics and stuff I still have. I have a couple Rode NT. I have a Rode NT1 and a Rode NT1A. I've had those for ages. Those date back to like the band I was playing in college called Curious Few. That was, you know, back 2001 to 2003 or 4. So I have those. I bought a Neumann TLM-103.
Yeah.
And that was used for most of the vocals. So those mics got the heaviest workload. And then I just have, you know, I have an assortment of all variety of other mics. I have like an AKG C1000. I'm not sure if that one got used. I mean, I don't remember specifically using that one. I've right. got, you know, SM57 to 58s. I've got, those are probably all the mics that would have been most likely to be used. And then I was using a PreSonus FirePod as a digital interface.
Okay, yeah.
I just sold on eBay. I still had my FirePod, so I bought a new recording computer a couple of years ago because that old Toshiba died and I didn't really want to use my personal laptop anymore for recording. So I bought a desktop computer and bought a whole new rig, bought a Focusrite Scarlett. But I still had that FirePod lying around and I just didn't really know what to do with it. I didn't think it was worth anything, but I just realized it, a few months ago, I put it up on eBay and I guess people are still using them. So good for them.
Yeah.
And then I don't know other, I think that's all the most relevant technical side of it.
Right. What do you remember what program you were using? Was it like a Pro Tools or was it something more simple? Like
Audacity? I was using Cubase.
Okay.
Yep. Cubase. I don't remember what version, but yeah, right, I was using Cubase. I've now switched to Cakewalk, which so far I have had no complaints about. Seems to do everything that Cubase did and it was free. So,
right.
I haven't seen any reason to upgrade. But yeah, I liked Cubase. If I could have still used this, I still had my old software. So if I could have used it on the computer, I just bought, I would have, but it wouldn't work.
Right. Yeah. And then, because I'm such a speaker head, were you doing much on like headphones or did you actually have monitors?
I did have monitors. I had a pair of Alesis M1 MK2. Does that sound?
Yeah. I mean, I know Alesis.
They were Alesis monitors. They were pretty low end. I probably paid $250 each for them back in like, maybe less than that, maybe $200 each for them back in 2003 or so. I think I bought them when I was recording my first album. Yeah. And I did a lot of headphone mixing too. I got rid of the monitors. I don't have monitors anymore because I just didn't have space for them. Place for them now.
Right.
But so everything, I've been working on some new music and everything's just going through headphones, but at some point I'm probably going to have to invest in some smaller monitors or something else to give me that aspect of mixing.
All right. And they, it's really incredible, I think, what they can do now, especially on the smaller footprint side of things, because I heard a pair of Presonus monitors. It was a few years ago, but I think they were only 4-inch monitors, and I was completely stunned by how loud and the amount of bass that they could put out and everything.
Yeah, yeah. It helps to be a singer-songwriter, you know, playing acoustic guitar, and because I don't really need that much bass response. Obviously, you want to know if it's there, but most of my music doesn't have that much bass in it, so I've gotten away with not having the best monitors. But yeah, part of me is excited to start looking at monitors to buy, and part of me is terrified because I don't know. I'm not good at choosing.
Yeah. And it's hard, especially if you can't go demo them somewhere and line them up and listen to them all. Cause I'm fortunate enough to live within drivable distance of a Sweetwater, and I can go to the showroom and listen to just about anything they've got. So, one of the questions I wanted to ask, because we talked a little bit about Counting Crows, but I was wondering who your influences were going into this, and were you calling back, I guess, on music you grew up with, or was it something more contemporary that you had been listening to at the time, or who influenced your songwriting, but also your lyric writing, and I was just curious if you had any cool stories about that.
It's challenging for me to identify influences. You use that word specifically. There are plenty of musicians I like who I'm sure must have influenced
let's go that direction then.
But I do have two specific influences on this album that I'll get to. So I was a big fan of Dar Williams growing up. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's a singer-songwriter from Western Mass. She's pretty big as far as singer-songwriters go. I don't know that she's still making music, but she was popular in the folk scene in the 90s and early 2000s. I love her songwriting. I love her music. I love her voice. And Patti Griffin, same thing. Although Patti Griffin, I was a little not as enthusiastic a fan of. I have one album of hers, Living with Ghosts, that I think it's one of my favorite albums of all time. So I love her songwriting and voice, and I love how that album is. It's very it reminds me of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska in the production. It's not overdone. Sparse. It's the production is sparse, and I really appreciate that. That's something I've struggled to do with my own music while also making it sound good. But I love that album of Patti Griffin's. And then Paul Simon, I've always been a huge fan of, both when he was with Simon and Garfunkel and just on his own. So I mean, pull any song from Paul Simon's catalog, I probably like it. So those are three that come to mind that I have liked for a long time. And I'm sure. Oh, and Adam Duritz. I mean, he's a fantastic songwriter. And like as we were discussing before, I love Counting Crows. But as far as like the musical influence on this album, there are two very specific instances that I can call out. Because as a not professional sound engineer, I had to call on existing recordings just to figure out what I was even aiming for. And so Dar Williams, one of her most famous songs is called Iowa. And that's on her album. What Kind of Fan Am I that I can't remember the name of this album? The Mortal City. So it's from her album, The Mortal City. And it's actually the track that first attracted me to her. I heard this on a drive somewhere. I think some friends and I were heading out to the East Coast back when I was in high school, and I just immediately fell in love with this song. And so I modeled the song A Child to Call Our Own. I didn't write the chords or anything with that song in mind, but when it came time to record and I was trying to figure out the arrangement, that song was guiding. And so the pedal steel that you hear in there is also something you'll hear in Iowa. That Dar Williams, Iowa, helped me figure out that A Child to Call Our Own needed a pedal steel, that it was the right fit for that song. And then the other example is the song Anne Marie, which is the second track on You Are What You Dream. One night, I don't remember when this was, early 2000s again, I was listening to WCBN in Ann Arbor, which is like the student, University of Michigan student radio. And they were playing this great blues song by a guy named Tab Benoit. And the song is called When a Cajun Man Gets the Blues. And it was, again, a song that just immediately struck me. It took me a little while to figure out what it was called. These are the early days of the internet not the early days of the internet, but it was early enough in the internet age when not every song lyric was found online. So it took a while to figure out what it was. In fact, I think I had to call WCBN and speak to the person who had been on the air and get them to tell me what their playlist was. Anyway, so okay, When a Cajun Man Sings the Blues is just Tab Benoit and his electric guitar. And I really liked that aesthetic. And I wouldn't say that it influenced the composition of the song, but when it came time to record and I was thinking, what else does this song need? That song helped, When a Cajun Man Gets the Blues, helped me realize that Anne Marie didn't need anything else. Just me and my electric guitar was fine. I just had to modify the arrangement a little bit to fill in the lyrical gaps so that it stayed musically interesting even when I wasn't singing.
Well, this guitar and I have been around, met many girls in many towns, and I've been true to the one heart given to me. But as the chorus boomed and we locked eyes and she broke into that piercing smile, oh, I knew how deep in trouble I was bound to be. Anne Marie, cut from the cloth of a fantasy. But I've got a woman, she's everything I need.
Sorry, I had a train of thought while you were talking. I was trying to just to listen and not interrupt you, and I kind of lost it.
That's okay. Take your time.
I do remember what I was going to say. Even the most professional engineers that I've ever met use a lot of reference tracks, I know. So I wouldn't say that that's a quality of not being professional enough. Because I know a lot of people will load them right into their Pro Tool session or whatever and list and cue them up and play them right alongside whatever they're working on at the moment. So that's a pretty common tactic, I think, in the industry of mixing and mastering.
It makes sense.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a lot of times where you're trying to compete with other contemporary people and you want to know what they're doing and you don't want to sound out of the groove, so to speak, of what, you know, other metal artists or other pop artists or whatever are doing. So you and cue their stuff up. And
why reinvent the wheel? There's no, you know, you're not less of a sound engineer for, right. I agree. I felt no compunction about doing it. If I made it seem like I did, then I apologize. I had no moral compunction about ripping off other people's mixes. None at all.
All right. Well, I just wanted to make sure that you knew that was a pretty common thing. So if you're doing that with your new record, that's still. And speaking of, is there anything you want to talk about this new music you're working on, or is it still too early in development to really speak to it? Or,
you know, some of the songs.
Or you just don't want to. If you don't want to, that's fine.
I had recorded very little in the last 10 years, really, since You Are What You Dream came out. But I had written plenty of songs. So a lot of the songs that I am now thinking about recording or have started to record are old. Some of them even feel dated, and I'm trying to decide if I still want to record them. But I have this massive volume of material that spans a decade. And so as far as music coming from, you know, one person could be, it's pretty diverse. The last 5 years or so, I was at there's a festival here in Seattle called the Folklife Festival. It's a free festival down at the Seattle Center where the Space Needle is. And there's dozens of stages where you can just hear a wide variety of folk music, anything from, you know, contemporary folk like singer-songwriter stuff to really traditional folk music from other parts of the world. And I was there, I want to say, in maybe 2016, and I heard a group of people singing sea shanties, which, you know, have kind of blown up in the last year. There was a little fad there. Well, I was singing sea shanties before they were cool. let it be known. I got really into sea shanties, and there's a few groups around town that get together once a month or so and sing these old traditional folk songs, sea shanties among them, not strictly sea shanties. And so I've written a number of a cappella tunes over the last few years, some of which fit in that traditional vein, and some of which are at least the subject matter or the content of which is more modern. But those are songs that I would not have been writing 10 years ago. And then I also have this catalog of rock songs, I guess songs that would fit a rock band. They're not heavy. You know, it's not metal by any stretch, but it's certainly not singer-songwriter material. And they've never been recorded because it's a pain in the ass. I don't know if I could say ass on your podcast, but it's a pain in the ass to like find a drummer and it's just more difficult to record, and so I just haven't done it. But I'm more determined now to make some of those songs happen. Still figuring out how, but
sure.
I have a number of songs like that, and I'm still writing new ones. So I'm excited to get to them all. It's slow going. There's only so much time in the day that I can commit to it. And it takes a long time when you're doing it by yourself. So I've been working on one song. It's an a cappella tune that I'm really proud of the songwriting. And I recorded all the melody, myself singing the melody, and got that all mixed. I was happy with that. And then I recorded harmonies for the choruses, and those turned out really well. I recruited a bunch of people I'm friends with on Facebook who just wanted to participate. And they sent me in their recordings from, this was during the pandemic, so early stages of the pandemic, like 2 years ago. So people just emailed me their parts, and that all came together nicely. But then I realized like the verses just felt a little naked. And so I needed to come up with harmonies for the verses. And I've been struggling with that for 2 years, maybe a year and a half, let's say. And I'm finally making some headway on that.
So yeah, well, whenever you do get around to releasing some stuff, I will be excited to take a listen to it, and maybe, who knows, maybe you'll come back on and while you're trying to promote it and get people to hear it, and you'll let me in on some behind the scenes stuff, and we can talk about that some other time.
Well, there's one song that you could. So on my YouTube channel, I don't post that much on YouTube, but every once in a while I post something. And last spring, I quote released a track called When You Land, and one of my favorite songs of all time is Joni Mitchell's This Flight Tonight. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
I know Joni Mitchell, but I don't think I know that song.
So that's on the Blue album. It's I think track 3. One of my favorite songs of all time, and it tells the story of this woman, of Joni. She's on a plane going to visit a lover. And she's nervous about it. She's uncertain about their relationship. She's uncertain of her own feelings. There's a lot of anxiety, and the song is sort of her processing this anxiety as she's on this flight. So I tried to imagine what it was like from the other perspective, from this person she's going to meet, who's at the airport waiting for her. And I painted a very optimistic picture. He's madly in love, and he's this sort of removes all uncertainty about their relationship. So I recorded just a very basic, not live, so to speak, but just me and my guitar. I didn't add anything else. And I just put that on YouTube last, I think it was May or June, because it was the 50th anniversary of Joni Mitchell's Blue album. And I just wanted to acknowledge that and celebrate that. So you can find that track on my YouTube channel. And if you need the audio, I can send that to you. I'm really proud of that song. And I think when I do a studio version, I think it's going to be fantastic. This version is fine. I mean, I like it, but it's not a recording that I would release, that I would charge people money for.
Ooh, I've been wandering hot sweat through my caring for an hour, too revved up to wait for you at home. I brought a coffee thermos and a fresh bouquet of flowers. Now I watch arriving flights as they unload. Buzzing tourists spill into the neon Vegas night. Families come together from afar. And darlings run delirious, tossing bags aside.
Well, I will be sure to look that up. And it was funny was I basically had just been going back to Spotify to listen to Your Dream. And you were like, yeah, I've got a bunch of albums on YouTube. And I did a big face palm. I was like, why didn't I ever think to look you up on YouTube and see if you had anything else? But a lot of artists, if they have it on Spotify, they've got it, right. It's the same basically wherever you look. So
yeah,
but I was like, yeah, I should have looked on YouTube and some other places and run through whatever else you had. So I'll do that soon, I promise.
You'll find a few of those a cappella songs on there too, just live performances like at the sea shanties. And you'll find a few of those songs on there.
Okay, cool. Well, I will be sure to check those out sometime soon. And if you got any other things, because we talked about Spotify and YouTube, is there any other place that people can find your music, or is there any other places that you want to promote, or any other projects you're involved with you want to promote, or anything else you're free to
do whatever
you want?
I have a website. I don't really update it, but it's peterrothbart.com or poemadept.com. They both go to the same place, so PeterRothbart.com, that's R-O-T-H-B-A-R-T. And you can find links to some of my music there. I think you can listen to a few tracks there. My YouTube channel is, I don't think I have a designated URL, but if you look up, sorry, I just went to my YouTube channel and started playing something. If you look up Peter Rothbart on YouTube, you might find me. I don't know. Let's see what happens. I'm looking myself.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah, you'll find me. It looks like. Okay. It looks like I'll be one of the first results. At least when I look it up.
So when you go to YouTube and you type in Peter Rothbart and you see a channel named Peter Rothbart, that's you're in
the
place,
if right? there's only like there's 77 subscribers, so let's have more. Yeah. More than that would be great. I don't release that much stuff on YouTube, but I want to in the future. So so that'll be a good place to look for live performances and such. I would also call out, let me pull up and get the URL right here. So Aura Riddell, who we talked about, was plays a great role in You Are What You Dream. Her website is auraridell.com, AuraRuddell.com. And then she has links to her music. She's got her own albums and fantastic work to listen. One of my favorite song of hers is called, what's it called? Synapse. So I recommend taking a listen to that. Aura plays the koto, which is a beautiful sounding instrument. And she if it's featured on the koto is featured on that song Synapse, and she has other good songs too, but that's just my favorite of hers.
So those dang multi-instrumentalists, so talented. But yeah, so well, I think I've taken up over an hour of your time at this point. That's, so
no worries.
But
actually, there's one thing you didn't bring up that I thought you were going to, that I think is worth bringing up. That is, you initially said something about Angels on Dixborough Road, which is my favorite song on the album, and is a true story.
Oh, really?
Yep. So both Bring You Home and Angels on Dixborough Road are true stories. Anne Marie is notably not a true story.
Okay.
The one where I cheat on my wife is not a true story. Although it's there was a girl Anne Marie was a real person who I met during a performance with that Irish band who did leave me her number, but that's the end of it. That was the end of the real story. But then I wrote the song from there, right? It was funny having to explain when I gave my wife's parents copies of my CD when it was that year on that tour in 2012, and I gave them each a copy of the CD, and I explained to them, I was like, look, you're going to listen to this song. I just want you to know it's not true. Okay. So that was fun. Anyway, Angels on Dixborough Road is based on an experience I had my senior year of high school. My friend and I were driving around late at night around Ann Arbor, and we came upon, it was the middle of winter, came upon a truck that had run off the road, and we were bored and we stopped to help. And immediately upon confronting the driver, we could tell that he was wasted. And we decided to, you know, we tried to help him get unstuck, and in the process, a county sheriff pulled up, and something about my experiences as a teenager in Ann Arbor made me more sympathetic to the drunk driver than to the cop, which take that for what it is. I mean, I guess my experiences as a teenager with police were not positive. It always just seemed like they were there to hassle me. So allowing the cop to arrest this person seemed like letting him win.
Yeah.
Which now I think is stupid, but not, if the same thing happened now, I would be like, hey, arrest this guy. He's driving and he's fucking wasted. He's going to kill someone. But anyway, that's not how I handled it then. And I sort of fended off the cop so that the cop wouldn't come face to face with this driver. I satisfied the cop's curiosity, let him know everything. No one was hurt. We were getting the guy unstuck, and so he didn't see any need to stick around. We drove off. And then we, you know, my friend and I drove this guy home. We got his truck out. I drove his truck with the drunk guy. His name was Mike. He sat shotguns. And then my friend Ernie, who I was with, he followed in his parents' minivan. And I don't know, I just had this, probably took us 20 or 25 minutes to get to where Mike lives. Just had this long conversation with him. That he probably won't remember. He probably wouldn't remember. And just learned about, everything he told me just made me really sad. He was just like a not very happy guy, like getting drunk on the weekends was kind of what he lived for. He didn't say that, but that's how it seemed to me. And eventually we got him home and we deposited him on his couch and left. And he probably woke up the next morning either wondering, maybe he wondered, how the hell did I get home? And what happened last night? And what in the world? And maybe that was a habit of his. You know, maybe that happened to him a lot, that he got home and didn't know how.
Yeah.
Or maybe he woke up the next morning and he said, two high school kids carried me into my house last night. What the hell's wrong with me? Maybe I need to change. I've thought about, this is one of the most morally ambiguous situations I've experienced in my life. I think drunk driving is abhorrent, and I have no problem with punishing drunk drivers, but I also think that no one's perfect and people make mistakes, and I don't think we should be judged by, you know, solely by the bad things we do, the mistakes we make. And, you know, I like to think that everyone has potential to change. So what would have, which outcome would have been like the greater good? Would letting him get arrested have been better? Maybe. I mean, maybe he didn't learn anything and went out and did the same thing a month later and got an accident and killed someone. I don't know. Or maybe he learned his lesson and shaped up and stopped living life the way he was. But there's this old idea of like, I don't know where it comes from, but the idea that like anyone could be an angel, you know, the people you encounter could be, that you should always treat everyone well. You should always give everyone your best because they could be an angel. That feels a little judgmental to me. It's like, oh, you should be on, it's like being nice because otherwise Santa Claus isn't going to give you presents or something. But,
right.
But what I took from it is that like this guy, this drunk driver was put in my path and taught me a really valuable lesson, which is, you know, I get back in the car with my friend Ernie and we drive home and we're talking about it. And we made a pact right then to like never drive drunk. And not that I had a proclivity to, not that I was prone to drunk driving anyway.
Right.
But it's a pact that I've observed strictly. I don't drive even if I've just had one drink. Unless maybe four or five hours have passed. If I've eaten a big meal between, then fine, you know. But if I have a drink, I just don't drive. And I can't say this. I don't know if Ernie's observed it as strictly, but it has at least had an influence on my life. And so I think about this drunk driver being an angel put in front of me to teach me a lesson without having to pay the cost.
Yeah.
So that's the origin of that song. And it's my favorite song on the album. Well, not by a mile, but by a little. Some people just complain to me that it's too long, and it is long. I think it's like 8 minutes, but yeah, I think it's warranted. It's a long story. It's wordy. But if you can, if any of your listeners can get through it, I think they'll enjoy it.
Yeah. No, and see, like, I come from the background of like progressive rock and metal, and you know, listening to Rush and stuff. So an 8-minute song doesn't sound that long to me.
Right.
but yeah, that but it does definitely tell a very interesting and you know, literally and figuratively sobering the story. So I think we could all learn something from that. Yeah. So definitely check that track out if you're don't check out any of the rest of the album, which you should, right. But if you had to pick one, I think you should definitely check that one out.
And if I had to tell people to only listen to one song, though, I would tell them to listen to the first song, because that's also one of my favorites. But
yeah.
And we talked about my YouTube channel briefly, but I want to point out that I just recently uploaded all the three ALF studio albums that I've put out. You can listen to them all on YouTube. So all three of them are on my YouTube channel. So if you want to listen to any of my songs, they're there for your enjoyment.
Yeah. And if you're listening, please do. Please go check out Peter's music. Like I said, I've admired it for years now. And if you have any faith in my taste in music at all, and you think that I know what's up, then please, please go check out Peter's music. And if you got any other final thoughts, then please go ahead. But otherwise, I wanted to thank you again for giving me an hour of your time and the time it took to send some messages back and forth and get all this coordinated, and for just coming on and talking about music. And I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks for the invitation. I enjoyed chatting about this with you. It's been a while. This album came out a decade ago, and it's been a while since I've thought in depth about it. So I appreciated the nostalgia and introspection, the opportunity for those.
Yeah. Well, if you got through to the end of this, please now immediately go listen to some of Peter's music. And if you like what you hear, please leave a comment or like, subscribe, and follow him on YouTube and on Spotify, and hopefully we'll hear some more new music soon from you. And if you liked what you heard here on Michael's Mixdown, feel free to type in Michael's Mixdown, whatever your preferred social media is, and find me there, follow me, and share this around with your friends if you thought it was interesting. And if you like singer songwriter folk type music, then hopefully there'll be some good examples of that here edited in throughout the episode, and you'll get an idea what Peter sounds like, and you'll go check him out. So, well, once again, Peter, I just want to say thanks, and maybe we'll see you again sometime. If you got new music coming out, we'll talk about it sometime in the future. That would be cool.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, thanks, man.
AM out on Dixboro Road. Ernie and I are in his parents' minivan, driving around without anywhere to go, listening to the late night shows on WCBN. Around a curve, a truck is run off the road, and his axles tangled in the Michigan brush. High beams blaring through the gossamer snow. No one to help him out, no one but us. So we pull to the side. The driver says his name is Mike, and he thanks us for our time. Oh, we should all be so kind, 'cause you never know whose face hides one of God's angels behind. Mike says an ice patch spun him out of control. mumbles something about tires and treads. But I hear how his words come slurring and slow, and I can smell a night of alcohol on his breath. Well, a county sheriff pulls up onto the scene and asks for the driver to get more details. And something tells me if I don't intervene, Mike's gonna end up spending some time in jail. So I step in the way and I blather at the cop whatever I can think to say. And when he seems mollified, he shuffles over to his cruiser, rubs his hands and climbs inside. Spend untangling the thorns, hacking away with dull Swiss Army knives. When we're done, Mike says he won't make it home, hands me his keys and asks if I'd be kind enough to drive. So at 3:30 a.m. out on Dixboro Road, Ernie stranger inside. Back in the van, we swear a solemn oath. Whatever happens, we will never be that guy. Why did we help him? He could have killed someone. What dumb impulse compelled us to get involved when life puts you on some strange new trajectory?